our time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
This is a very special edition of the Topple Uncaged podcast. For listeners who live with chronic illnesses such as ME, Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, or other things that affect cognitive impairment, just to say now, this is a fairly complex episode. There's a lot of medical terminology. There's a very long and involved story intertwined throughout this. So, for those listeners, I have put in breaks throughout the podcast where you can pause, take your time, digest the information that's been given to you, come back to the next stage if you want to, just to try and make this listening experience easier on the ear and on the mind. I do hope you enjoy it. Say, I have a very, very special guest on today's show. She is here to talk about a issue and situation which is very, very close to my heart. Many listeners will know this and they'll understand when we get the conversation going today. But it is an issue which is extremely important and extremely under-discussed and under-reported in this country. I've been chatting to her off air. She's absolutely amazing. She is such a character, so on point with what she's going through and what she's talking about. Real fascinating lady. This lady is here to talk about a relatively unknown, but as my partner Nicola Jeffrey would say, it's not rare, it's just rarely diagnosed, chronic illness, which has multiple implications on the human body. And she's here to talk about her journey, but also what she is now doing to raise awareness of what can be a life-threatening and debilitating condition. As I said, it's very close to my heart because this lady lives with the same conditions and illnesses that Nicola does. I'm very pleased to welcome her to the Topple Uncaged podcast. It is Samantha Smith is here. Samantha, thank you so much for coming on. I've already had such a fascinating and great time speaking to you off air. And now we've hit the record button, but we're just going to carry on like we were just talking normally anyway, aren't we? Hello, Samantha.
Absolutely. Hi. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. It's a real pleasure because I think what you're doing is extremely, extremely important. And I think your voice needs to be amplified as much as possible. Now, for listeners at home, this is quite a complex subject in some respects. However, you know the Topple Uncaged podcast. We will break it down into a way that you can understand. So I'm putting my Jennifer Aniston L'Oreal hat on and going to say, here comes the science bit, because it's quite technical. But we'll get into that shortly. But Samantha, what I want to do to start with, you've had quite a journey to get to the point where we're at now, essentially, to even get to July 2019. It's been quite a journey for you through the medical profession and trying to get answers to what illnesses have been blighting you for a good part of your life. I mean, in short, you live with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Some listeners might be aware of what this is. Mm-hmm. And you also have been living with something called craniocervical instability. We'll talk specifically about them more in a little while. But first off, I mean, these are two, Ehlers-Danlos is a genetic condition. Craniocervical instability is often a consequence of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. But you didn't get these diagnoses straight away, did you? I mean, when did you first know in your life that you were not well, that there was something sort of rather wrong with you? When did it first notice, and how did you then get to the point where you had correct diagnoses?
I first started feeling particularly unwell when I was pregnant with my first child in 2008. I started developing all these rare conditions. I was being told it's hormones, but it's unusual. My son needed to be born early because my liver and my kidneys were poisoning him. They were just basically shutting down. He was 4 months old and I got pregnant again. And my daughter, this time it was just like all of the symptoms came back with a vengeance and poisoned her. And then eventually my placenta failed. So she was born prematurely via emergency C-section. And throughout the pregnancies, I remember, you know, like getting stuck on the floor with a bad back, having problems with my hips. I was told that I had SPD, so symphysis pubis. Basically, my hips were dislocating and too loose and moving around too much, causing a lot of pain and instability for me. And then I was told that as soon as I'd had the pregnancies, the hormones would calm down and everything would start to improve. That never happened. So I then ended up at 22 years old with two children under the age of two and a body that was not functioning. I was on crutches. I was struggling to walk. And I'd have some days where I was okay. Do you know, I carried on with university. But to be honest, I was in quite a mess and wondering what on earth was going on. And doctors were telling me they couldn't find anything wrong. And I was just a stress mom, finishing off a degree with two young children. So I had nothing else to work with. I started thinking that I was a bit soft and trying to toughen up. Sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. No, you carry on. I was just going to say that's a story that probably resonates with 70 people. That you're just stress mum. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But carry on. So you were a stressed mum who was trying to do far too much. Little woman shouldn't be doing this much, obviously. So what happened next? I mean, did you get progressively worse?
Yes, I got progressively worse. So I then started collecting different consultants, I guess. I had a number of different issues. I had seven different consultants, different symptoms, different parts of my body. And to me, as a layman, I would look at it and think, surely it's got to be one thing causing all of these issues within my body. But these consultants didn't want to know about the other conditions. They would work with their system and that was it. And none of them, every time they'd do a test, and none of them could ever find what the problem was. So they'd medicate me, trial and error. And I just felt like it was the same story repeated in different systems of my body. This carried on. So I then ended up a single mum. I went to do my master's, struggled through that. My health got worse and worse. Again, I was being told that it was stress. I was under a lot of stress at the time, but I knew it was something more. Do you know, other people were under stress and my body wasn't reacting the same as theirs. I would travel to 10-mile journey to university, but I would need to pull over and have a little sleep on the way back, otherwise I wasn't safe to drive. And these little things I was being told, you know, you're just tired, you need to rest up more, you need to take care of yourself. Then eventually I got to being, I owned my own business. And I guess looking back in hindsight, the reason I set up my own business was because I knew my body could not withhold working for somebody else and their structure. So I set up my own structure. I'm a psychotherapist. So I built a private practice in Manchester City Centre. And I built that around my children, what they needed, my health, what I needed. And then gradually over time, I'd say 2016 was quite a telling year. Things really started to go downhill. And I was told I had viral meningitis, but nobody did the, I've got a mind blank. Nobody did a lumbar puncture to prove it. So I was told it was viral meningitis. I had this horrific pressure in my brain, something that I remembered having after being in labour. And it was a very specific pain in my head, which I knew I'd had once before, and that was it. Got admitted via ambulance to hospital. It must be viral meningitis. They sent me home to recover, and it took me a long time to recover. And just as I was beginning to recover, still having a lot of pain, still would be very clicky, my joints would dislocate, I'd pop them back in, but I didn't realise at the time that's what I was doing. I was just putting an uncomfortable thing back into a comfortable place, you know. and working with my clients and running these businesses. And then I remember being on my way home from work one day and thinking, my back's killing, I can't wait to get in a salt bath as soon as I get home, leaning on the steering wheel at the red light, and then this articulated lorry comes and smashes into the back of my car. And a few days later, I actually thought, well, it hurt me, obviously, it caused me problems, but I didn't think it, I thought I got away lightly, and that was that. And then a few days later, living on my own with my children, I wake up on my living room floor and I'm thinking, like, did I just fall asleep? Was I meditating? What has just gone on there? Dismissed it. A few more days later, wake up on my kitchen floor, full of bruises, bit my tongue, burst my lip. I'd had a seizure. And I phoned a friend and said, you know, I need you to take me to hospital. And this is when then the tests started happening. So they started doing tests, neurological tests, can't find anything. Cardiological tests, can't find anything. Well, we're finding things, but they weren't adding up. Nothing was adding up. Sometimes there'd be a problem, other times they'd look and the problem had gone. And this was happening neurologically on scans. It was happening with my heart as well. I had a scan of my neck, a lie-down scan, a regular scan on the NHS. It showed that everything was perfectly fine. But in the meantime, getting to the point where I was just desperate. I was losing my business. I was losing my ability to even parent my children. I was pretending to people that I was working when really I was in bed like asleep thinking, I'm just being soft here and I'm not as strong as everybody else and I can't cope with life. And I started researching online. I came across this thing called EDS and then this thing called cranial cervical instability. And I said to my rheumatologist, I've got EDS. I know what it is. We finally found what it is. I know what it is. She said, no, you're wrong. You're not hypermobile enough. So actually this went on for that had gone on for about 5 years by this point. And at this point I went to her and said, look, not only have I now got EDS, I also believe I've got something called CCI. And I am not leaving this room until you send me to a geneticist. I'm not going to leave, that's that. And I was just desperate. And she sent me to a geneticist who said, you're the most obvious case of a connective tissue disorder I've ever seen. And that was on the NHS. So that was enough to me. But then her response was, there is nothing we can do. This is likely to get progressively worse. I would let you know that a lot of people find it beneficial to go and see a man privately, a professor in London privately, maybe try and go and see him. So I went to see him. And then he diagnosed me with likely cranial cervical instability. At that point, I had lost the ability. So I'd gone from running mental health, psychology columns in Cheshire magazines, in local magazines, and running two clinics. And I was also an international best-selling author of self-help. And I got to the point where I just wasn't even able to really string a sentence together. Each night I'd be having a seizure on the floor before crawling upstairs, putting my children to bed. And I reluctantly ended up wheelchair bound or just bedridden. I needed to be laid flat at all times. And nobody had an answer. Nobody could tell me why. So the same day that I got this scan result off the NHS saying everything was fine, no abnormalities detected, I also got a private scan which I'd had done in an upright position. So to me, at this stage, I had a connective tissue disorder, which meant that the glue in my body was not holding my body together as well as other people's. And so if you use your common sense and you've got gravity, you would say you're lying down and everything falls into place and you stand up and suddenly you've got problems and you've got pain. And that's when you should scan somebody, when they've got problems and pain in that position. So I paid thousands and thousands of pounds. I had these scans done. And on the same day as the no abnormalities detected because you're lying down and everything's fallen into place, I got, you've got 8 to 10 weeks to live, or you need your spinal cord and your brainstem decompressing and your spine reinforcing. And this surgery is not available in the UK and you need £250,000. And that is when March 2017, when everything changed and I lost my business, and it was all about Save Samantha campaign, and it was all about fundraising.
I'm just going to interject at this point. There's a couple of points I want to pick up on. I should just say, and I should have said this in the introduction, I'm sure you won't mind me saying it either. One of the symptoms of your, well, several of your illnesses is cognitive impairment, isn't it? So if you sort of forget yourself, it's part of the Ehlers-Danlos syndromes. It's part of instability. It's also part of myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly known as ME. So if Samantha stutters a bit and I have to interrupt, that's why, because trust me, Nicola's
I need redirecting. Yeah, absolutely.
That's the one. Yeah, I know it all too well. So that's that. Can I just ask you, I didn't realize you had a light road traffic accident. So is the implication that it made it worse, that it did something extremely serious?
I guess at the time I never ever linked the two together, because it was just there was an accident and then there was this thing that meant there was something wrong with my brain, and your brain, you automatically go to, I've got a brain tumour, and then the neurologist sending me to the heart specialist, and it's like, oh God, there's something wrong with my heart. And I was redirected, I guess, away from thinking it was linked to the accident. When I went out to my first neurosurgeon who understood the condition, at the time he was based in America, he said to me, having opened me up and looked at the damage caused, he was very shocked that he'd never seen anything like it, and that it was definitely caused by trauma. But he does believe that with regards to, I mean, we're at a higher risk of CCI, of the cranial cervical instability in our neck, with having EDS, a connective tissue disorder, but at the same time, it is often triggered by some sort of trauma. So it wouldn't surprise me, however, the two are not officially linked together. They're in my story, but not.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, because it staggers me. I just want to, I'll touch a bit more on sort of, as you say, the sort of trauma and EDS is not linked together. I will touch on that, because I'm quite interested with regards to your thoughts on that. But so for listeners at home, I mean, essentially, what you were living with all this time was Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which was it hypermobile subtype?
No, I was originally diagnosed with hypermobile subtype, and it never added up because I've not been a party trick person, do you know? So by a party trick person, people with hypermobile subtype are generally thought of as the ones that are contortionists and can do all of the, you know, the stretchy hand things and everything else. I can't really do any of that. My spine's hypermobile, and it turns out now that we know that all of my organs are, so the connective tissues inside of my body. I had my first stabilization surgeries believing that I was hypermobile EDS. And then I came back and looked in for more testing. It was thought for a while that I was vascular. And now it turns out that I've got a rare type of classical, which is not yet understood enough to really get us anywhere, to be honest with you. We've got a vague understanding of which collagens it affects, and that's that, you know. But I know it affects my interior more than my exterior.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something which is sorely misunderstood with Ehlers-Danlos, because the publicity in the media tends to be around hypermobility and people are double jointed and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not.
Yeah, they want the party tricks.
Yeah, and it's not the case at all. I mean, for listeners at home, the way they measure hypermobility is something called the Biten score. And it's not spoken about enough, the fact that you don't have to score on the Biten score to actually have Ehlers-Danlos at all. No. You can still zero, and it doesn't make any difference. But I mean, you sort of summed up quite nicely what Ehlers-Danlos is. I mean, in layman's terms, it's essentially where the collagen in your body, it does not work properly. It's lax. Things aren't held together as they should be. And therefore, the implication with the craniocervical instability that you talk about is essentially what happens in a person's neck who has craniocervical instability is that the ligaments that should hold their spine in place and make their spine maneuver in the way that it should and that it was designed to do, these ligaments are lax and they're basically floppy. And so what happens is the spine moves in all sorts of ways it shouldn't do. It generally affects the top four vertebrae, and they move over each other in ways they shouldn't. Quite often, as you described, what happens to you, dislocations happen. In Nicola's case, she has subluxations, which are partial dislocations of the facetal joints in between her vertebrae every time she twists her neck. And in many cases, Nicola again, it causes the vertebrae to compress the brainstem, and in the most severe cases like yours, it can cause your skull to collapse onto your spine, can't it? Yeah. Essentially.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's where we got to in early 2017. Yeah.
I mean, then that's a very layman's terms overview. I mean, there's 14 plus subtypes of ELOS, DANLOS, isn't there? As you pointed out, there's vascular, yeah, hypermobile, classical type 1, classical type 2, and they're still discovering more and more to this day. Yeah. And craniocervical instability, which is the instability where the third and fourth vertebrae are affected, is quite often coupled by something called atlantoaxial instability, which is where the first and second vertebrae are also affected. That can manifest in lots of other ways as well. There's sometimes intersections with something called Chiari malformation. There's intersections with cerebrospinal fluid leak. It's all, there's a multitude of sort of cluster effects which come off of having ELOS, DANLOS. And the most serious in your case, and in many people's cases, is the craniocervical instability. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. If you need to take a break, feel free to do so now. We're going to give you a few seconds, or alternatively, you can pause the podcast here and come back when me and Samantha will be talking more about her journey from being a stressed out mother to finally getting the correct diagnosis and to fusion surgery. Join us here again in a few seconds. I mean, so you went to a US neurosurgeon. He opened you up, and he was quite shocked at what he saw. What were the next steps for you then? Because, as you say, this operation is not available in this country, so the US was your only option, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I mean, there was, at that point, there was just newly developing potential surgeon in Europe, in Barcelona, but it was very early stages for him. He wasn't somebody I wanted to experiment on. Well, I didn't want anybody experimenting on me, you know, so... it was a case of, can I raise this money? Can I raise £250,000 in 8 weeks initially? I was at the point where I was told that I was on the verge of internally decapitating. So where you talk about the atlantoaxial instability, the C1, C2 vertebrae, mine were 90 to 95% overhang. So mine were literally just hanging on by 5%, 5 to 10%. And that was causing huge issues cognitively for me, but also, what did it just in every part of my life, to be honest with you. I was having intermittent paralysis, I couldn't think clearly, and I'm trying to run a fundraising campaign, which thankfully I've got incredible friends who helped me with that. We raised the funds, we raised enough to be able to go to America. At this point, I went to the person that I believed from researching online was the best person that I could go to, and he suggested a couple of surgeries, which kept changing the more studies he did on me. Eventually, I woke up and I'd had a different surgery to what I'd thought I was going down for, but he did what he believed was right. He stabilised posterior C2 down to T2. So he left the where I was about to decapitate. He didn't operate on that area, because he made the decision that if he stabilised underneath that, that would be enough then to restrict the movement and allow above to just balance nicely on top without it causing any problems for me.
Listeners, so no, I'm sitting there shaking my head, but carry on, Samantha.
Yeah. I'm carefully choosing my words.
Quite.
I woke up from surgery. During that exact same surgery, he also released occult tethered cords. So my spinal cord had attached itself lower down in my lumbar spine, and he released that for me. And it was then a point of, you know, you recover and you go home. In Washington, I've got two young children. You recover and you go home as fast as you can. But I knew from the minute I woke up that I was still unstable. And I kept saying, I'm dislocating. No, it's not possible. I said, no, I'm dislocating. I know I'm dislocating. Kept being told it wasn't possible. Anyway, eventually, stayed there for a month trying to argue that I was dislocating in my neck still, and tests showed that I were. And so we decided to stabilise the C1, C2, what we were speaking about, the atlantoaxial instability, which were then never attached to the the fixture below. So I had two separate fixtures. And basically what was said to me was, you have so many I look at it like a firefighter, the surgeon said, and you have so many fires going on inside of you that I'm going to put out the worst ones first. And I understand that. You know, we have so many problems. It's like, where on earth do you start? It's overwhelming. So he puts out the ones which are life-threatening, and he believes you stabilise the larger part of the neck, which should hopefully then stabilise upper and lower when done correctly. Unfortunately, this was not enough for me. And so I came home having had three surgeries in Washington. I came home 4.5 months later. I had success for a few months, started to walk, learnt to walk again, learnt to function again, tried to come home and look after my two children on my own, failed. Also went through a stage what nobody ever seemed to talk about, which is you wake up from surgeries in another country and you're on drugs that they would never give you in England, many, many, many drugs. You hypermetabolize them because you've got a connective tissue disorder, which a lot of people hypermetabolize them. And you are left to then try to withdraw off these drugs yourself. And so I was then withdrawing off drugs, very, very strong drugs, LSD, tablet form of cannabis, and three different morphines, as well as oxycodone, and ketamine. So I had all of those drugs. I was then trying to withdraw these drugs and trying to, as I'm withdrawing, I'm thinking, my gosh, more symptoms are coming back. Am I better or was it just hidden by all of these drugs? Moved in with my parents because I needed some help. And gradually, this was September 2017. I'd had the surgeries in July and August. By January 2018, I was bedridden. Absolute mess, didn't leave bed for 6 months. And things just got worse and worse, and I knew then I'm deteriorating and I need further surgeries. This has not been successful at all, and that was where I was at. There was no help in the UK whatsoever. Nobody's trying to give help. There was no help.
No, and obviously I know that all too well. I didn't know half of that. While we were chatting off air, I'm literally gobsmacked. I didn't realise what this particular neurosurgeon had actually done. And excellent point as well about the fact that when you have treatment abroad, you're quite often given medication which you can't get over here. I mean, that's a completely under-discussed point in all of this as well. So you'd had these multiple surgeries, all of which were, I'm sure you don't want to say it, I'll say it, essentially botched, and were a complete sort of misnomer from the outset, obviously. When you hear you explain it, the fact that, oh yeah, I've stabilised your top two vertebrae by not stabilising them, but stabilising the ones underneath. It's just staggering. I mean, absolutely mind-blowing. Yeah. That
it enabled some scientific studies, though.
Sorry. Yeah, exactly. Enough said on that, I think, for the minute. So fast forward, we're in 2018 and you're no better off, essentially. So, I mean, so were you at the point then where you were back to this process of having to fundraise again to go out to the US to see someone else? Is that what happened next?
That is exactly what happened next. So I had had such a successful fundraising campaign. To raise £250,000 in less than 8 weeks was immense. Absolutely blew my mind. And then to come back and to have to say to these people, they'd witnessed me go through it, they'd seen my highs, they'd seen my lows, they'd seen me really desperate, recovering, and then suddenly she's better again and this good news is released. And then all of a sudden it's all failed. And I hit a really... I just hit rock bottom, because to stand there and to have to tell people publicly, actually, I made a mistake, and oh, the surgeon made a mistake, and that surgery has not stabilised my life. My life is still at risk. I now need what, at that point, I believe to be £250,000. We then reached £250,000 in, I think it was November 2018. Mm-hmm. At which point I spoke to a new surgeon who said, look, you've deteriorated so far and you need such aggressive surgery that you need £320,000. So we'd hit this target. I've been so desperate. I was so, never thought for a single minute that people would help me hit it again. We hit it again. And suddenly I had to say, we need another £80,000 and we need it in the next 5 weeks over Christmas. And to me, that was the point where I just gave up. I thought, there is no chance on earth people can do, even if they want to do it, there's no chance that anybody can do it. There's no chance that anybody's got that kind of money to be able to save my life over Christmas when they've already saved it once and it failed. And somehow they did. And in January, we got the money together and everybody else got the money together, really. And I went to Arizona. I found a new surgeon through an online support group. And one lady who I communicated with, who was like, I was kind of almost at the leading stage then within the group. So I was at the point where I'd had the most surgery, I guess, is what I mean by the leading stage, is that it was, I'd had so many experiences in different aspects of EDS that people were coming to me for help and advice. And there was one person who I thought, I've not had that much surgery in it. Didn't want that much surgery, but she was this incredible woman in America. And I reached out to her and she was trying desperately to find somebody, a surgeon who was not as well known, but was skilled, highly skilled. And she recommended somebody to me and I went to him. And he was in Arizona. I went to him in January, had the surgery in February. And within, it was a 12-hour surgery. And when I woke up, I just knew straight away I was fixed. It was amazing.
So, just so I suppose people listening can understand, I mean, we get the point that before you essentially, you were bedridden, quite often with paralysis. You were telling me that you're having seizures as well, and that essentially the most serious aspect is that your vertebrae could self-decapitate you, essentially cut your spinal cord, which they could because of the laxity of them. So you went from that to having the surgery in February of this year, where they essentially fuse your vertebrae together, to put it in sort of simple terms. It's obviously more complex than that. Yeah. Had the surgery. We're now in July after February. What has the difference been to you after having correct, by all intents and purposes, as we stand now, correct surgery? What's changed?
Oh my gosh, everything's changed. I can only ever explain this by saying pre-surgery and now. Pre-surgery, I was spending 24 and a half hours a day in bed. That half an hour a day was for my children. As soon as they came home from school, I would see them. I would always fight very hard to climb the stairs and put them to bed, do the bedtime song, do the bedtime routine, you know, because that's precious to us. And it's always only ever been the three of us. But it got to the point where even that wasn't a possibility. And so it was, they come home from school, mummy sees them, mummy plays with them, and I'd still have to be lying down while I did that. You know, it's not playing with them. I'd just be communicating with them the best that I could. I'd have earplugs in, I'd have dark glasses on, because any sound, I could hear my own eyeballs moving, the pressure in my head. You know, any sound was horrible, and any light was painful for my eyes. I had to be in a lay down position to reduce the pressure off my neck. My legs had grown weak. The pain was immense. I didn't have a life. I had half an hour with my children, and they'd come into me and they'd hug me a little bit, and then they'd be bored and they'd be off, because the children, and that's natural. And I like that. I like that they needed to carry on with their life, but I missed them. And now we came home from Arizona. I'd had my surgery in February. We came home at the very end of March, first day in April, I think it was, we arrived back home. I moved straight home to being a single parent with my two children. I was capable. I mean, by capable, I've got a carer, she helps me out, she does the housework stuff, the things that will then save me energy so that I can give my energy where I feel I need to give it, which is my charity and my children. Not in that order. And now I can even, you know, I can walk to school for them some days. So I'll have crutches, I might have my walker, sometimes I might need my wheelchair. But I have experiences of a typical life, like normal, but of a normal life. I went to a PR event at weekend. I have hugely suffered for it since, but I went. And these are things that, like, you can't put a price on. I'm living, I'm making a difference, and I intend on making a difference to other people's lives that will outlive me. And that makes my life worthwhile in my mind, and the fight that other people gave me worthwhile. So,
no, absolutely. And we'll come on to what you're doing with the charity a bit later on. I want to drill down into the situation within the NHS in this country, because I think it's one of the most staggering aspects of the story of everyone who firstly lives with Ehlers-Danlos syndromes and secondly, therefore, lives with craniocervical instability, atlantoaxial instability, or both in some people's cases. I'm trying. Do you know what? I'm trying very hard to be professional throughout this, because I'm professional all times, obviously, and I'm trying hard not to make it sort of personal. But obviously, as listeners know, and as you know, it is personal to me, because Nicola lives with both craniocervical instability and atlantoaxial instability, and I can't dress it up really in any other way than to say the NHS does not even recognise that craniocervical instability and atlantoaxial instability properly exist, do they?
No, they do not, and it is it's neglectful, it's dangerous, and it is going against their oath to do no harm. It's as simple as that.
I mean, what I find most staggering about it, that because you touched on it earlier with regards to the sort of intersection of trauma and Ehlers-Danlos, craniocervical instability is recognised firstly in people living with Down syndrome. It's recognised in trauma patients from road traffic accidents onwards. It's also even in some respects recognised in case of chronic infection. The inflammation can cause instability. That's all widely documented and reported. And yet with Ehlers-Danlos, where in my mind it makes perfect sense that your collagen's knackered, therefore your ligaments are knackered, therefore none of your bones and organs are going to be held in place properly, therefore of course your vertebrae is going to be knackered. It's not even recognised. And you did, I have, if you don't mind mentioning this, I'd appreciate it. You did an interview for BBC News. We're recording this on Wednesday, 9th of July. You did it last week for BBC News. And they asked the NHS for their response, didn't they? And the NHS England's response to the sort of you living with craniocervical instability and having to go abroad, it was quite staggering, to be honest, wasn't it?
It was the standard response. It's the response that I've had numerous times through different news companies. And yeah, it's along the lines of, and I hate to be misquoted, but I've read it a number of times. It's along the lines of that we offer this surgery is offered on the NHS, and it is offered when we believe that it is more likely to be when we believe that it is a positive thing and not going to cause detriment to the patient. Is that's not the correct wording, but that's the along the lines that they're going for. It's not true.
That I'm sorry, I was mouthing then. I'll just say anyway, that's a fucking lie.
Yeah, it's not true. And I have. Do you know the funny thing? Whilst I was unwell, I was gathering evidence because I was convinced I was dying. So up until 3 months ago, I'd planned my funeral. I'd planned my children's, you know, how they would cope with it. Tried to prepare them for it. My family, everybody and everything was as organised as it possibly could be when you know that you're going to die. And I had an evidence file. I have an evidence file. And in the evidence file, I had contacted everybody of any influence within the NHS, within the government, or within healthcare. I'd asked whether they intend on educating people, whether there is any intention of building any courses, whether these courses exist, whether anybody is specifically trained, whether there's any training available during medical training for any professionals. There isn't any. There's none. There's no intention to give any training, and there's no training that exists. So how on earth can they then claim that they offer this surgery when they consider it more beneficial than dangerous for a patient? It doesn't make any sense. There's nobody to make that actual decision. Nobody dares to make the decision. And in addition to that, I had an email from a neurosurgeon, which was possibly an accident on his behalf, over in the UK, which stated to me that upon speaking with the accrediting bodies for neurosurgeons, so it's the people who accredit the neurosurgeons within the UK and allow them to practice, they made it very clear to neurosurgeons that if they offer this surgery for people with my condition, that they will risk censure from his or her colleagues. So you've then got neurosurgeons who might be able to make the decision by looking at your scan and going, oh, actually, I think it's beneficial for you to have this stabilisation, like this one did initially, who then go to a meeting and get told, you could lose your job and you're going to lose all accreditation to practice. And he goes, hang on, there's other lives that I could be saving, or I could fight for this one here. We don't win. And he told me this and he wrote it down, and nobody will respond to that comment.
I bet they won't. And it's endemic of... It's endemic of the healthcare system in this country, and I know I may come across flippant by saying that, and there's broader points that I quite often make on this, but it is, and that kind of approach unfortunately doctors are put in a position where if they tread too far outside of the area which the NICE guidelines and their regulatory bodies allow them to work within, if they tread too far outside, they're risking their jobs and their mortgages and their families, etc., etc., etc. And this is, of course, as you know as well, because you also live with this, this is very widespread in myalgic encephalomyelitis, also known as ME. We'll get onto that later, but yeah. I'm not surprised, and I bet I knew which neurosurgeon that is as well, actually, who accidentally sent that to you.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind.
Once again, feel free to take a break from listening, pause the podcast, come back to it at a later stage, or just go and grab yourself a tea or coffee or other drink. Me and Samantha will be back in a few seconds talking about this time why she thinks and why I think the NHS doesn't recognise conditions such as craniocervical and atlantoaxial instability. I mean, do you think, with regards to the NHS... Is it literally just a cost issue, do you think, or is there something deeper going on? Because obviously listeners at home need to understand, essentially, if when you go for an MRI at hospital, standard MRI, you lay down. The only way that craniocervical and atlantoaxial instability can be properly diagnosed is with an upright MRI machine. Now, if you haven't seen one of these, which you probably haven't, it's like walking into something out of Star Trek. It's essentially this huge machine which like fills an entire room, and you go into it and you sit down. You're kind of elevated up and then elevated down, and the woman goes outside into like this docking station and controls them and maneuvers from outside of the room, and you're in there for about an hour. But what it shows is a completely different perspective of your neck and your skull and your head. But these machines, the cost is astronomical. Do you think it's as simple as it is a cost issue, Samantha, that why we're not recognizing these instabilities on the NHS, or is there something deeper going on? I'm interested in what you think.
Purely my opinion. Initially, I thought it was a cost issue, yes. Initially, I remember saying to my neurosurgeon, you just let me die because of money, and begging him and sitting there with my dad and saying, I've got two children. And I was 30 years old at the time. I'm 32 now. How can you allow my life to go just because I need a surgery? And really begging and thinking it was all down to money. What do I think now? It's very hard to believe it's purely money when you come up against so many egos. Now, I'm a psychologist, so I've got a good understanding of the ego, and I still completely, role play almost everything that I'm going to say before I go to an appointment with a specialist, because, you know, if you accidentally hurt his ego, you're in trouble. It doesn't matter. In fact, the higher up he gets in the hierarchy, the more trouble you're in. And it sounds so unprofessional. Having worked in NHS and private healthcare myself, it doesn't... I don't think I would have believed it quite the same having not experienced it. So I record every single appointment that I go to.
Yep.
Yeah, without fail, absolutely record everything. So I've got everything written, audio, transcribed, the lot. And now, looking at that, I would say that it's far deeper than that. With regards to ME, with regards to EDS and CCI and this need for this surgery, originally I was saying, well, they must think that it's not worth fixing us because they put a load of money into fixing us and we're going to have another problem because we've got connective tissue problems and that's about our whole body and it's going to cost them more. But then you look at childhood cancer, you look at lots of different issues, lots of different illnesses, which are not actually, which are more rare than CCI with EDS, even though the statistics are not correct right now, okay, in my belief. And you know that there's a likely going to be a reoccurrence of certain cancers, and yet they still treat it. These lives are still worthwhile. They can't. I don't know if it's because they can visibly see something. My brain, I personally think, I have a theory that they being bigger than the NHS, have denied acknowledgement of this condition for so long, so many lives have been lost and damaged, that it is far more dangerous for them to acknowledge it than it is beneficial for them to do so. Unless we become a privatised care country, at which point we become like the NHS, where they look at us and go, oh, we can make a lot of money from you because every part of you is falling apart. And then they might start to acknowledge it. But as an NHS, I do not believe that, I just believe they've turned away too many of us. It's egos.
I think a lot of what you said is spot on, actually. I have a lot of respect for some medical professionals. However, I think a lot of them are very much driven by their egos. As you say, there's this damning image which always stand out, which I used in an article once, was that someone put it on Twitter from a doctor's surgery, something along the lines of, why do you think your Google search is better than my degree? And the doctor's surgery had put this up in its patient waiting area, and it is, wow. And it is that kind of attitude.
I actually have that said to me.
You have had that said to you?
I had a gastroenterologist say to me, I said, I believe my connective tissue disorder is causing gastroparesis, which is paralysis of parts of
essentially what it is where your stomach doesn't empty as quickly as it should do, isn't it?
Thank you, yeah. And he said, well, you like Google, and I am the doctor, and my son's a doctor, my husband's a doctor, and you like Google, so you'll do what I'm telling you, it's IBS. Now, he hadn't done any tests on me. He was telling me it was IBS, and that was that. And it was the case of that. It was, you like Google, and I'm telling you it's this, and you just have to nod and smile and go along with it.
It still makes me angry when I hear stories like this, because I've literally witnessed it with Nicola myself. But it just beggars belief. The thing is with the NHS, my opinion is very nuanced on the NHS. I'm, as people will know who know me and who know my writing and broadcasting, I'm all for a free NHS. In fact, I think it should be free, that we shouldn't even pay any national insurance. It should be something the government provides regardless. However, yeah. With regards to chronic illness, it fails people terribly. I always say that it's in the same form that it was in when it was found 71 years ago, in terms of that people go in sick one end and they're supposed to come out better the other, all lovely and happy, and go back to their 2.4 nuclear family. But for chronic illness and ME and EDS especially, it doesn't work like that. And there's a real systems issue. I mean, you talk about sort of egos and what have you, and I think that's true in the medical profession, especially, as is misogyny. But I mean, do you not think that we're dealing maybe less with the problem with actual medical professionals? Not all the time, because some medical professionals are absolutely terrible, it has to be said, but less with medical professionals in the NHS and more with the systems and policy and sort of over and above the heads of the NHS problem here. Is that what you're kind of getting
at? Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. as I touched upon with you, we've got egos. Egos are in any career type. And yes, we do come up against them as individuals who happen to work within the medical industry. However, ultimately, it's systems and policies that are working against us. They're outdated. They're no longer working for us as a general population. And like you said, you know, it's designed for you to go in sick and come out healthy. And we're going in sick and we're coming out with our symptoms treated and our condition still exists. And if you've got a chronic condition, you don't fit into that. The box can't be ticked. It's a very difficult experience. Sorry. Completely distracted then. But it's completely, you can come up against doctors and individual specialists who care and they want to do everything within the power to help you, and yet their hands are tied because the system doesn't work that way or because their policies do not work that way. And that is not enabling anybody to provide holistic care. It's not enabling anybody to work with another health professional to join up the dots to provide diagnosis of anything, to provide, like I say, all-round care for anybody, which is what we need as people with chronic health conditions.
I think, yeah, you summed it up with holistic care. That is a brilliant point, and it is sorely lacking in terms of every area of chronic illness within the NHS. But of course, it's not something that is currently pushed by any institution, unfortunately. But no, I concur completely agree with your points there.
Thank you.
I think you're on the money when you say it's partly down to egos. I'm afraid it is. There's a certain arrogance. There's also rampant embedded misogyny within the medical profession for patients. But I also think you've touched on something extremely important there as well when you say that because of how many people have gone before, and I dread to think how many people have actually died because of craniocervical and atlantoaxial instability, that it may well be that they're too far gone. Because the challenge with it is, and this actually leads me on to what I want to talk about next quite well, but the challenge with Ehlers-Danlos syndromes and therefore the instabilities is that for so many years people have either been told it's things are all in their heads, that their illnesses are down to or you're just stressed or you're overworked. People who had hypermobility Ehlers-Danlos would have been 20 years ago, 30 years ago, told that they were just double jointed, and that when they were children they had growing pains. It is staggering to think exactly how many people live with this. I mean, the most staggering statistics for me are the fact that in this country, if you base on the statistic that on average 1 in 5,000 people live with Ehlers-Danlos, don't they? That's the official statistic that's touted by the charities. 1 in 5,000 people. That works out to just over 13,000 people in this country live with Ehlers-Danlos. You're telling me it's only 13,000 people? On our estate, there's my girlfriend, there's her mother, there's her brother, there's my girlfriend's son, who are all hypermobile, but it's only 13,000 people in this country. Yeah, all right then. Couple the fact that the statistic is a gross underestimate, and then marry that with the fact that, because of the fact that not many doctors still know about Ehlers-Danlos, then you do have this perfect storm of that. If you really drill down into it, and if you really opened up this can of worms, it would be so torrid of what's actually gone on in this country, then I don't think they'd want that can of worms opening. I think you're quite on the money.
And it goes, you know, it's not what you just said. We live in a small village in Greater Manchester, near the Pennines. Very, very quiet, quaint little village. And yet, in my children's school alone, there's 5 children with it. Now, that's a school of less than 150 children.
Work the statistic out.
Not my relatives. I'm not even counting my relatives around the corner. It doesn't add up in the slightest. But like you say, it's a lack of diagnosis and multiple issues.
It is, yeah. And as I said, that leads me into what I sort of want to talk about next, to start tying this some of this together, really, actually, as well, Samantha, because it is lack of diagnosis. It's also the notion that a lot of illnesses Are all in people's heads. And one of those illnesses which has been widely touted as always being in people's heads is ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis, which we've already sort of skirted around, which you live with as well and which Nicola lives with. For listeners at home, if you don't know, but I imagine a lot of you will know this because I bang on about it, myalgic encephalomyelitis is a chronic neuroautoimmune systemic disease. The causes of it are currently unknown. It's thought to be a result of a enterovirus infection, which essentially damages your system permanently and never leaves you as such. There's thoughts that there's a dormant virus circulating. Some schools of thoughts put it down to the fact that this enterovirus causes what's known as hyperperfusion, where the blood supply to your brain is cut off and therefore causes stroke-like damage to your brain. There's loads of other theories. No one's ever pinpointed exactly what the cause of it is specifically, but it's had a long and torrid reputation. It previously was known as chronic fatigue syndrome. It's previously known really as hysteria. And for decades, and right up until this day, it's still, many in the medical profession still view it as a psychosomatic disease. It's all in people's heads. And currently the guidelines within the NHS for treatment for this disease, which has pathological causes, are cognitive behavioural therapy and graded exercise therapy, even though one of the major factors of ME is intolerance to exercise and exertion, and it just makes people worse. NICE is currently reviewing the guidelines for ME regarding CBT and GET. I should add, in the US, both of those treatments have either been downgraded or banned by the Center for Disease Control and the US government, but we still have them over here. The point of my rambling about ME, because I always go, I just roll off this script now because I've talked about this so many times, but my point of rambling about ME is because you also live with it. It's similar to Ehlers-Danlos in terms of, firstly, the symptoms that manifest with Ehlers-Danlos and ME in some respects can be quite similar sometimes. It's very, when you live with both, as I know from Nicola, it can be very difficult to pinpoint what pain is down to what discomfort is down to which, what bodily dysfunction is down to where. It's very hard to pinpoint them. I mean, in terms of you, what was your, briefly, because I don't want to sort of get into it too much, but briefly, what was your sort of pathway to getting an ME diagnosis along with an EDS and your instabilities? How did that pan out for you?
An ME diagnosis came first. So
right, okay.
I was diagnosed with a number of different conditions, misdiagnosed with a number of different conditions, including fibromyalgia, which I may or may not have. I don't really know if I've got it or not, because like you say, there's so many crossovers. And then there was ME, and I remember a doctor saying to me, okay, look, we've ruled everything else out. This you're either an exhausted mum who's working too hard, and I'm like, no, it's more than that, you're not understanding, or you've got ME. And I ended up with this diagnosis of ME. And at that point, I remember thinking, what you've done is told me I'm chronically fatigued, and I've come to you to tell you that. Like, I want to know the cause. I want to know what's really going on here. And I dismissed it for a long time. That's not a diagnosis. It's just a name. And, you know, I guess, I don't know if it was denial, whatever it was, I dismissed it. And was eventually diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And alongside that, like I say, came along the CCI and the AAI and now Chiari I've got, and a bunch of other issues. But that ME is too loud to be ignored, is all I can say. It is the most, it's cruel. It's such a cruel condition. EDS is a cruel condition. ME is really cruel. ME has really hit me hard. You know, you're like, I have peaks and troughs, and certain things flurry, and I'm beginning to realise what, like, certain foods might flurry, certain actions might flurry, and sometimes doing something is worthwhile, even though I know I'm going to have a flare-up the next day. But the flare-up I've had this last 3 days has been pretty horrific, and it feels like you are trapped. You're a prisoner inside your own body, and it doesn't matter how hard you want to wake up or how hard you want to make sense and send that message from your brain to your mouth to make a coherent sentence, it isn't going to happen. And if anybody, I actually did a video this morning, and if anybody witnessed, I don't know if I could bring myself to share it, the video this morning of me trying to put a coherent sentence together compared to now, they'd be quite shocked. That was Emmy.
I think it's a brilliant way of summing it up. I say brilliant, not as you know what I mean. It's a very, very accurate way of summing it up. And yeah, I totally know what you mean. Nicola's had a really bad day today, and is currently she wants to speak with you, as we discussed off air, but she can't do it. She literally cannot come and speak to you. She can't come out of bed. It's. The reason I ask you about ME is because I'm leading into something in particular. Mm-hmm. Obviously, regular listeners to this podcast will know that I do talk about ME a lot. I've written a lot on it. There's loads of stuff on our website about it. So I don't want to kind of get into the where's and the why's of ME that much, aside from saying that, as I previously said, it's very similar to ALS analysis in terms of that it's not a rare condition, it's rarely diagnosed, and it's very misunderstood in the medical profession. The reason what I'm getting at is essentially that you know, I'm fascinated, and I have to put this question to you. You obviously know the story of Jennifer Breer, don't you?
Yes.
For listeners at home, there's a lady called Jennifer Breer who made a documentary back in 2017. It was a film called Unrest, and she, fit, healthy, done a degree, perfectly normal, quote-unquote, person, suddenly got a really bad viral infection and was struck down by ME. And she documented it on film about her journey to trying to get answers to ME. She had all the symptoms. She met every international classification criteria going, and went through this journey. She tried everything. I remember from the film, there was a segment where she went and lived outside in the tent because she thought it could be mold related. It was an extremely powerful and eye opening film. She then found out, as well as ME, she found out last year, that she was also living with cranial cervical instability. However, she had not got a diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Recently this year, Jennifer Breer has had fusion surgery to correct her instabilities in her neck. And she had tethered cord syndrome as well, didn't she? And she's had that corrected, which at first made her instabilities actually worse. And then she had another operation. She's had it corrected, and she is claiming, along with several other people, that the fusion surgery to correct her instabilities has appeared to put her ME symptoms in remission. Now, I don't want to put you on the spot here, and I'm not asking the question to put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. It's because I want to have a chat with you about your thoughts on it, really.
Yeah.
First off, I mean, obviously, it's wonderful for her. I know Jennifer Breer, and it's wonderful news for her. And it's opened up a whole field of debate, hasn't it, really, about ME and Ehlers-Danlos. I mean, in terms of your experience for you, have you seen any difference in your ME symptoms since, firstly, having your fusion surgery?
To answer that question, yes, I did. I saw a huge improvement initially. So, as I say, I've been through this a couple of times now, and each time there's been a huge improvement. I spent, from my initial surgery in 2017 through to my surgery this year in 2019, bedridden. And that was largely due to ME, and then the rest of it was due to the fact that when I was upright, it triggered all the rest of my symptoms. ME, CCI, AAI, whatever it was, I've got full spinal instability, so there's always going to be some kind of problem there. Then I had this surgery, and I came home and suddenly didn't need to nap in the afternoon. My children picked up on it. My daughter only said to me the other week. Now, the thing for me is that I then went and had pelvic organ surgery, quite a major pelvic organ surgery 5 weeks ago, and that has re-triggered my ME. So although it stabilised it, it hasn't stabilised it long term. Now, it's still far better than it was. Far better. I mean, I still get a life in between my downfalls, but it is not consistent. And I keep thinking about this, and I wonder, now I'm well known to have instability. They never stabilised my C0 to C1. I've also got Chiari, the belief that my cord has retethered itself lower down, and that I've got instability everywhere where it isn't fused, all the way down to my pelvis. So at some point, I'm likely to end up fully fused. But I wonder whether that has something to do with the fact that Emmy sometimes rears its head again with me and hasn't gone into remission quite like it has with Jennifer. When I saw Jennifer's unrest, that I was in between surgeries, and I messaged her over and over again. I was like, I know what you've got. I was so passionate about it. Like, I watched it and I cried for days, and I contacted her and I said, you've got to get this checked, and you've got to get this checked, and I believe you've got CCI, please go and get it checked. And when I saw her in the neck brace, I was like, thank God, you know, she's had it checked and this is what it is. And not because of me, I imagine many people have felt the same and contacted her and said the same. However, we have spoke briefly, and she hasn't yet gone through full test, or unless something's changed since we last spoke, she hadn't at that point gone through full testing to check for EDS or connective tissue disorder. And I do wonder whether there is still an element of that. Whether there is that connection. And I also feel that there's potential that because there's still stress and strain being put on my spinal cord, because I've still got instability lower down, that is causing, I put pressure on myself, I do too much, that's then triggering my ME. So yes, I do believe that there is some kind of link. I'm not sure how strong it is.
That's really interesting. I literally support what was interested in your thoughts on it, to be honest.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind.
And this is your final break in proceedings. Once again, take a rest, rest your ears, your mind, and come back to me and Samantha when we'll be talking more about the intersections of ME and Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, how Samantha and her family have coped with her quite remarkable and quite distressing journey, and why she's setting up a charity. Join us back here in a few seconds.
I think me and Nicola talk about this a lot, and it's we were really, when we saw Jennifer Breer's news, I have to be honest, it was a really mixed bag of emotions, because at that point, because the thing is, me and Nicola are doing things sort of the other way around to you. We're dealing with the ME primarily first, firstly because we're not sure how severe the CCI and AI is, in all honesty. I mean, she's not nowhere near the extent you were in terms of the fact she's like paralyzed, but she does have seizures, as we've discussed. She has gastroparesis and slow digestive transit. She has issues heart and lung function. She has weaknesses. She has this sort of occipital and parietal headaches, etc., etc., etc. But we're dealing with the ME first. So, of course, we're going through all this and a huge treatment regime at the minute to try and get the ME banished from her body. And, of course, when we saw Jennifer Breer's news, we were like, fuck, okay, that's interesting, because obviously, and we were like, okay, so are we doing this the wrong way around? Is this even going to work? But then the more we thought about it, and it's Nicola who's drawn this conclusion, and she breaks it down very simply, but I think she's on the money, and again, I'm interested in your thoughts. Mm-hmm. I mean, she basically says that it stands to reason that people with EDS are probably more susceptible to ME, because you're already working with a broken body in the first place. And the very fact that your collagen makes up, I think, 80% of your body, really, doesn't it? It's a thing that binds everything together. The fact that that doesn't work in the first place, everything's going to be lowered immune system-wise. So, of course, you're going to be more susceptible. And there's probably something which has not been properly researched yet, where there is a distinct link between people with ME and people with EDS. But as you pointed out at the top of the show, you don't have to be hypermobile to have EDS. But the problem is, currently the diagnosis criteria for especially hypermobile EDS, but any other EDS, can be so subjective without genetic testing. How many people with ME also actually have EDS and don't even realise? I mean, what are your thoughts on the links between ME and EDS in that respect? What do you think?
I'm really passionate about all of this, because this is something that I spend my nights lay wide awake thinking about and trying to connect the dots between. Like, it sounds like you might.
You and Nicola just need to have like daily Skype calls, I think.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. From our beds, I imagine. But I think that this is the conversation that me and Nicola initially connected on Twitter. Yeah. So I'd seen something with regards to Jembria, and I'd commented, well, to me, common sense is you've got a body and it's under immense strain. It's struggling to even hold itself together. Of course you're going to be chronically fatigued. And then people were at it, well, it's more than just chronic fatigue. No, I understand that. I live with it. I know that there are far more symptoms that surround it. But which symptoms are a part of the chronic condition that you've got? You know, is chronic fatigue a byproduct of another condition? Sorry, is ME a byproduct of another condition? Or is ME a standalone condition? And I guess that, in essence, is, I guess, what you're asking my opinion on. My feeling is that it is likely to be a byproduct of other conditions. You put huge pressures on the body and it's going to struggle. It's going to have the symptoms and the effects of ME. And I've seen it in myself. I've seen you release the pressures, you improve things, you give me a helping hand and I feel great for a few days. But ultimately, it's still there and my body is still struggling. It's still struggling to hold itself together. I'm going to become exhausted and I'm going to have other symptoms and issues.
Yeah. I mean, that's in part, yeah, where we're kind of working towards in our own heads with that. I mean, I think in an ideal world, I'd like to get all the EDS doctors, all the ME doctors together and lock them in a room until they actually decide to work together and come up with some answers.
Yeah, I mean, who says it's not the same thing? You know, who says that it's not? Mm. Like you said, how many people with ME haven't got EDS? How many people with fibromyalgia haven't got EDS? All these conditions that we're often misdiagnosed with or co-diagnosed with, these people should be working together as scientists, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly so, exactly so. And it infuriates both of us that this co-working doesn't exist. I mean, to give credit to Jennifer Breer, she sort of tried with the whole Nightingales group and the whole thinking behind that. I'll put the link in the show notes to what Jennifer Breer has been doing on Nightingales. But yeah, there's something up, and a lot more research needs to be done into this, and very bloody quickly as well. I mean, I'm still amazed by your story, I have to say. It's quite, I mean, I've heard some stories, yours is quite something else. And do you know what, the most sort of jaw-dropping part for me, and I don't know why, actually, I don't know why it did, but I was reading a text from you, and I literally went, what? And you're a single mum as well.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be shocked, because Nicola's had exactly the same journey as well. Sure. But it just still shocks me. It still shocks me that women specifically, because it is more women than men, women are left in these positions where they essentially have this awful choice between putting their children first and neglecting their own health, or putting the health first and therefore neglecting their children. And there seems to be no in between with it. I mean, like I say, I literally vocalized my shock when I read the text. I mean, how have your children dealt with all this? Because it must have been mind-blowing and distressing for them in equal measure what you've gone through. How have they dealt with their mum's journey, essentially?
I think what you just touched upon then is that, yes, it affects you as a parent, but it also affects relationships, and that makes it very difficult. So if you're deciding on whether your health comes first and your children's, your relationship doesn't get a chance, it doesn't get a look in. That aside, how has it affected my children? They were 6 and 7 when mummy was first dying, and they're now 9 and 10. It wasn't something that I could ever protect them from, because it had to be in the national and international media. It had to be well known. It had to be in the local papers. Otherwise, I wouldn't survive. I needed that support of other people. And so they were asked in the playground. There were no protecting them from any of it. It was a case of, yes, I could tell them, you know, journalists overreact sometimes to sell a story so that we get more money for surgery, and, you know, tell them that to protect them a little bit. But the rest of it was that they knew that mummy was going to die without the operation. They knew mummy might die with the operation. They knew that there were lots of different potential outcomes. And I can't imagine for a single second the extent of damage that that's done to them over the past two and a half years. I can only comment on the children that they are now. And at 9 and 10 year old, they're really wise, very different children. I think it's benefited me that I'm a psychotherapist. And so my son in particular is very much a psychotherapist child. You know, he's straight into using therapeutic techniques and all the rest of it. And the like, her walls are right up, and she's like, I can't love you while you're dying. And then the minute that my life was saved, it was, I saw this difference in her, and she could suddenly love me again and be close to me again. She just needed to protect herself. So it's affected us in monumental ways, my whole family and my close friends. And that's something that we are only just getting to the point of being able to acknowledge now, because we've been in survival mode for so long. So as of April, we've come home and we've been able to go, is this real? Okay, this is real. Not dying anymore. What the hell has just happened? And then other lives go back to normal, and I don't have my business. I don't know this body. And there's lots of different things that I'm coming to terms with, and my children are witnessing that, and we're trying to navigate our way through it. But they're just incredible. They really are. Like, we are a team. I don't know where I'd be without them.
Oh, that's great. Excellent. Mm. I'm pleased about it. I love the fact that you're a team. I think that's very, very important. And how about you? Because the one thing that Nicola always finds is, in many respects, the most difficult thing to deal with. She always says she can cope with the pain. She doesn't mind admitting she struggles with the cognitive impairment. She finds that extremely frustrating. One of the most difficult things for her is the isolation that comes with this, because of the fact that Emmy, Ehlers-Danlos, and the instabilities and everything else that she's living with, and everything else that people with those three illnesses also live with, because it's so hard for people to understand, because you get up in the mornings and you can almost look perfectly normal. If you put some war paint on, people wouldn't necessarily know you were ill, apart from the fact you have a neck brace on or walk with crutches. She always finds the isolation most difficult, and people struggle to understand that just how ill people with ME and people with EDS and people with instabilities are. I mean, how has it been for you? Because it can be very isolating, I know. What's your experience of that?
It's been quite the roller coaster, because, like I said, I have immense support around me, otherwise I wouldn't be alive today. And these people have saved my life multiple times, and so I've got a really incredible community with regards to my whole Save Samantha campaign and the people around that. Amazing group of friends, which I never knew friends like that existed. There has been a complete shift in many aspects of my life. So the people that I thought without a doubt would be there for me have disappeared, and people that I didn't even really know existed before, I've stepped up and I've never left their side. And it's been like this whole shift of, I now feel like I'm moving forward with the people around me who I always imagined would be around, like incredible people around me. However, it's hugely isolating that nobody sees. I was trying to pinpoint this morning and last night when my ME really kicked in this last few days. And I could not put a sentence together. The thing that always comes out of my mouth is I can't get my words from my head to my mouth. And that's about as complex a sentence as I can say. And when that happens is I normally use writing to communicate with people, or use my videos. When that happens, I can't write because I can't put a sentence together. And I can't do videos because I feel really stupid. I can't say very much. I can't put words in the correct order, if that makes sense. I can't articulate myself. And it makes life very difficult. People then only ever see me when I am able to articulate myself. They only hear me when I can articulate myself, and therefore they get the wrong image of who I really am. They don't get to see the 100% me. and only the people who are very close to me get to see that side of things. And I did attempt to do a video recording of myself yesterday. I fell asleep mid doing it. I tried to do it afterwards. I rewatched it and I kept falling asleep, but ultimately it never made any sense whatsoever. I don't even know what I was talking about. Could I put that out there? I don't know. Maybe I will, because people need to see this is me now and that's me a few 12 hours ago. But it's very hard. I'm not sure I would have ever understood that. It's so isolating. You are trapped in your own body and you can't explain it. And you're very lucky if people love you and understand and can see that and can see the pain that that causes for you.
I think you summed that up very eloquently, and you had no trouble getting your words out there. That was extremely...
I've got words written down on a piece of paper in front of me for when I forget them.
Yeah, I know, so I know all about that as well. I think you summed it up brilliantly. But you are moving forward with this, and I mean, this whole... somewhat, in some respects, unbelievable. I'm not shocked by it, but I still find it quite staggering. This, as you said, roller coaster journey you've been on. It's not over yet, because the sum of all the parts of this story essentially are that you are bloody determined to do something about this now. And you are setting up a charity essentially with a view to actually changing some stuff in this country and further afield. I mean, we haven't discussed this, so this is new to my ears. So what are you doing? What is the deal with your charity?
Okay. So basically, like you say, there were times when I've been rock bottom where the pain were all of the symptoms together, the pain and that feeling of being trapped and isolated has been overwhelming to a point where I look at my children and I say, this is a genetic condition. I had the benefit of being oblivious as a child to what my future might hold. You know, my mum, we found out, has the condition, but she's never displayed any symptoms. So I was completely oblivious till it hit me, until I was eventually diagnosed. My children look at me and might see their future. And that horrifies me. And to think that they'd look at me, see my future, and then live the neglect and the lack of care and the fundraising and everything else that we've had to go through is not okay. And so on the times where I thought, am I being cruel living? I'm making them witness what their future might be. Maybe I'd be best letting them be oblivious. And, you know, when I've been really rock bottom, the one thing that's pulled me through is the knowledge that if I live, I can make a difference as a healthcare professional and a professional patient. And I can use that knowledge from both sides of the chair, really, to be able to make a difference for the people. And so that's what completely drives me. My children drive me, but that is what completely drives me as well, because I need to change the way things are. So the charity is going to stay under the name Save Samantha, because my Save Samantha campaign was we've raised nearly £500,000 in 2 years to stabilise my life. So it's been a huge success. It's Save Samantha EDS Foundation, and the aim of the EDS Foundation is to educate healthcare professionals. So each healthcare professional, I'm going to work with, talks with the universities, and the intention is that each healthcare professional will have a set amount of hours of knowledge on EDS, on connective tissues, the way that affects the area that they're working in. They will also hear my story, other people's stories, to have that personal connection with it, that motivation to want to learn more. I'm going to have a hub where there are physical therapists who are trained in a very safe method, which will help. So that's providing preventative care. So ultimately then we're providing medical professionals with information and a CPD accredited course, which will enable them to provide early diagnosis and recognition of the condition. And then we're also providing healthcare specialists who have an understanding of connective tissue abnormalities, ME, its comorbidities, and can provide a safe physical therapy. And by doing that, then we're providing preventative care. And there are other ideas that I've got, other elements of this that then lead into research. But I'm not going to get too ahead with myself. If we get that far, well, we will get that far. If we get that far by the end of the year, that'll be brilliant.
That sounds absolutely excellent and sorely needed. And I love the, I'm just reacting because, like I said, I didn't know anything about this. I love the fact you're getting in to universities immediately, straight away, to change sort of mindsets and change thinking from them. Because you at the top of the show, you described it brilliantly where your first experience of the NHS was going to consultant to consultant consultant, and they'd only deal with their area and wouldn't put the whole thing together. And that is one of the biggest pitfalls for people with ELOS, DANLOS and chronic illness generally, that there was one, there was an immunologist who works in the NHS but also works privately, who we went and saw at Harley Street several months ago, and he said that the NHS basically may as well have big toe consultants because it's so split up into different specialities and they all only deal with their own area, and that's it. And I think getting into people when they're training in their chosen profession is an absolutely fantastic idea. I think it's very sorely needed. I think it's brilliant, and the hub as well is an excellent idea. I love it. Great.
Thank you.
How can people get involved, very briefly? Obviously, the full details for your social media will be contained within the show notes to this, but what do you need people to do at this time? Is there anything that people are doing, or are you just still setting up the
charity? No, absolutely. So I am setting up in the background. We have a number of things happening at the moment. I'm writing a book, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, with regards to the charity, there's a couple of campaigns coming up. And so anybody who's got experience of these conditions, if people are willing to write blogs, do vlogs, and I'm happy to backlink them, you know, to their websites, to the work that they do, and they're willing to share their story, then even better, because just together we are stronger. And it's my intention. We've got a website that's currently being redesigned, rebuilt in the background. That will be up and running within the next fortnight. And alongside that, there's two campaigns going. And one is to prove that there is a benefit to people who've had the cervical stabilisation, and making sure that we're seen now and we're heard now, because obviously when we're suffering and we're in need of it, we're not heard, we're not seen, we're pushed aside. And then the other one is to just demonstrate that there are so many people who might even have the same type, same subtype of EDS, and it shows itself in such a different way. And I'm wanting people to just share the story, share their experiences of it, and be able to just demonstrate the way that it shows itself so very differently. And if we can do that on the website, that will be hugely beneficial. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I will put all the links to that in the show notes, so people have places to go, and I'm sure this will be shared widely across sort of patient social media and supports and advocates social media as well. Wow, that was quite an interview. Samantha, thank you so much for coming on to talk at such length about what you've been through and how you've got to this point, and also your thoughts on everything. I think that the more people that speak up about this, the better. And I think there needs to be a real consensus now, led by patients, I have to say, about trying to forge new ground and to get these illnesses properly recognised, and also get professionals finally working together to try and bring some relief and get to the real causes of this. But initially, we need a campaign like Save Samantha to actually get the ball rolling on this being recognised in the first place. I think it's fantastic what you do. I think you don't need to hear that you're brave, but you are brave, and also I think you're extremely eloquent in the way you put all this across and put it together. That was absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast for the minute, Samantha.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
And that's it. That very special episode of Topple Uncaged is done. I'd like to thank my fantastic guest. She was incredible. It's the wonderful Samantha. Follow her on Twitter. It's at @SaveSamantha_. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to the love of my life, the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. You can follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicholas C. Jeffrey. My man behind the booth, my sound engineer, it's Gav Paws. You can follow him on Twitter. It's at Paws with a Z Radio. And my in-house singer, it is Ray Star Music. You can follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray_Star113. Thank you so much to the Canary for uncaging me, as always. I will see you again very, very soon.